This week, we're going to talk about court Jews. What were court Jews? No idea. Diamond. You had me disappointed. I thought you knew everything, practically.
People who rose to prominence in the Enlightenment.
There's truth to that, but it's a little more than that. Yeah.
Do you fear the king of wherever they like the government of wherever they lived in, like in the ghetto, so they lived outside the ghetto?
Okay, there's sort of truth to all that. Okay, so let's go through what happens, how court Jews come into play. I hold it's an important development.
It helps define the modern depiction of the Jew.
Well, let me put you this way. It's not only that, it's the beginning of the court Jew and the era of the court Jew is, I personally believe, the opening page, the introduction to Jewish Enlightenment, to Haskalah. That's my opinion.
It existed for so long in all of Europe.
Let's try to give some basic definitions, because we talk about the era of the court Jews being from the mid-late 1600s to the mid-1700s. The Rothschilds already are a little past that. And I'm going to give you my opinion. No one really... In Wikipedia, they try to claim that Barbonneau was a court Jew. And I don't really... It's like... No. If you say that, you have to throw in... What's his name also? You have to throw in Yosef Hanagid also. That's much, much earlier. There were... In other words... There were. Let's focus on what a court Jew is as best as we can, and then we'll see why I don't think that's. I think there's an era of the court Jew, and after a certain time it finishes. I thought that talk was real, and let's try to focus on it as best as we can. Okay, so we saw already that there's a trading network of Portuguese Jews, starting from they start. They spread their tentacles all over the Mediterranean basin. On one hand, Italy, very, very big part, very, prominent place for the Portuguese Jewish trading network. Turk in the Turkish Empire, also a lot over there. Egypt, we saw all those areas. They go also north to Amsterdam, Hamburg, which is northwestern Germany. There were attempts, not that successful, to extend it into Eastern Europe, but they weren't really that successful. Then not the Portuguese Sephardi trading Jewish network was not that successful. The farthest they really got north and east is really Hamburg. After that, nothing that super significant. So you take that. Okay, here let's diverge momentarily. What's going on in European politics is like this. We sort of discussed this, but I want to go back over it because you'll see this is definitely important. What?
Today or back
then? No, back then. Back then. Okay. Martin Luther starts the Reformation in 1521. Maybe it's 1519. I think 1521 is the right date. Sound right? Whatever. We don't have to look it right now. 1521 feels like it's the right date. Starts the Reformation. That sets off 100-plus years of confessional warfare. Enlightenment is the step afterwards. Martin Luther sets off confessional warfare, Catholic against Protestant. It gets a little more complicated later on. And I don't want to get bogged down in general history. It gets more complicated later on. The Renaissance is earlier. You have the Renaissance, that's earlier. And then you have the Reformation. Then I go from the Reformation. I have the Reformation.
Well, the printing press was what, 1400s?
The printing press was in the late 1300s. Gutenberg's printing press was late 1300s. It wasn't really that widespread. It gets much, maybe it's mid 1400s, early 1400s. Yeah, we can look it up. It's not so important. The printing press and printed material really in a significant fashion is really, you're right, is really around 1500. Late 1400s, early 1500s.
That was in Italy, of course.
It was Gutenberg was in Germany.
Didn't the Enlightenment.
The Enlightenment, the Renaissance started in Italy, but it penetrated Europe slowly through, you know, between the 1300s till the 1500s. Okay, yeah, there is a certain relationship, but I'm not worrying about that right now. Martin Luther sets off a major confessional Protestant versus Catholic warfare. Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor, who legally ruled all of the Habsburg territories, both German and Spanish and lowlands and the Spanish Empire, etc., etc., attempted to put down the German rebellion slash... I mean, you have to understand that the Reformation is a combination of a religious and national rebellion. It's more religious, but it's not only religious. Part of it definitely is national.
Well, it also sparked hatred towards Jews.
Well, no. In the beginning of it, it did not make much of a difference. The first stage of the Reformation, there was no... Martin Luther was anti-Jewish, and the Catholics were anti-Jewish. There wasn't that much of a difference between the two of them. And the first stage is Charles V was not as anti-Jewish as the Lutherans. I mean, it's a known fact. If you're not aware of it, it's a known fact that Luther convinced a number of people. I believe the Elector of Brandenburg was one of them. Yeah, so I'm forgetting. Maybe I'm possible. I forgot. I have a book downstairs I can check it up with. To expel the Jews from a number of places. Could be convinced also the Elector of Saxony. It's hard to remember, but he was certainly an anti-Semite, without a question. And in the first half of the Reformation, it didn't have that much of a difference for the Jews. And Martin Luther signed something called the Treaty of Augsburg. Not Martin Luther, sorry. Charles V signed the Treaty of Augsburg. And I forget the how to say this in Latin, so I'm just going to say it in English. And in Latin, it's a four-word phrase, which I just can't quite remember. The religion of the ruler is the state religion. Have you ever heard that one?
They use it in England a lot.
Okay, look, that's an interesting question. In other words, it's a fact. There's no question. There's no question. If we get, we're not going to get to der Jesus today. I don't believe we're going to get that far. But the facts are. E-agio, something E-agio is approximately, I don't remember it exactly. I have my book on the 30 Years' War, I can look it up, it's explicit over there. I have no problem finding it, I know exactly where it is. But anyway, it's definitely a European historical fact that from the early 1500s until the mid-1700s, usually if the ruler and the people didn't have the same...
Is it curious, regio, es, religio?
Yes, that's it. Thank you. Thank you. There you go. The religion of the ruler is the religion of the state. It was definitely the rule more than the exception was, is if the people in the state had one religion and the ruler had another, it didn't work. Now, the Muslims, of course, that wasn't true at all. No, the Muslims, it wasn't really true, but in Central Western Europe, it was 100% true. It was largely true. There were some exceptions here and there, as we get later on, but generally speaking, it was not a good recipe for them to have different religions. Okay. Chop. So then, this is sort of like an interesting thing. I'm going to tell you this has nothing to do with this class right now, but it sort of does. And that is that the religious wars of Charles V are very well documented, and the 30 Years' War is also very well documented. There happened to be a 60-65 year gap between those two things, which is not well documented at all. And that's sort of like from up to Shabtai Tzvi era is extremely well documented, and the beginning of Moses Mendelssohn, Chassidus, all that is also very well documented. There's about 100 years there in the middle that feels to me is not that well documented. I haven't yet completely proven it yet, but that's what it feels like to me. So we're trying.
In terms of Jewish history. What went on?
I don't know. But you'll see. It's either we'll get to it this week or next week. There's an event that happens in 1670 that in 1770 would not have happened. And it's something, and it's not random. It's a major event. Well, we'll get there. Hopefully we'll get there. Okay. No. So something you don't know about. Okay. So the 30 Years' War is very critical. The 30 Years' War is technically the grand finale of all of the confessional warfare which the Reformation set off. The defenstration, that's right. Very good. But in a different sense, after the Austrian Habsburgs overreached themselves, it was a slight overreach. They were opposed first unofficially, then officially by the French. Now, as we know, France, or maybe we don't know this, France is a Catholic country. And France is not merely a Catholic country. France for this period of time had two almost prime ministers who both were cardinals. Richelieu and Mazarin. And Richelieu and Mazarin are the authors of the concept, the European concept of raison d'état. They are the authors of, it was called raison d'état. That's how you pronounce it properly. In English you'd say it raison d'état. Which means reasons, d'état means a state. État is state. Here, let me show you something. Here, let me give you an education. Here, look. This is from 1 year. That's right. This is a French word. Okay? You never pronounce the last letter in the French word. No. And when there's an accent like that over the E, which and forget the name of it right now. What? No, it has a real name. I forget its name. It really originally was an S. Which, you see the word state there? It's just without the E. So in French, you take off. You don't pronounce the last letter. Don't pronounce the last letter, because in French, you know that you don't pronounce the last letter. You don't understand that? It's French. Oh, no. 85-90% of the time. I asked a Frenchman, why do you pronounce the last letter in some cities and not others? He said, we don't know why. That's just how we do it. That sounds very English, doesn't it? But the general rule in French is, and besides names, generally speaking, we don't pronounce the last letter. That word is état. It means really state.
Well, like
Jean-Jacques? Usually. No, names of places. I can't remember which names of places. I was asking them, saying, but this one, see, I know how you do it in English. How do you do it in French? What?
Orléans.
Orléans, you don't pronounce the last N and S. That's true, but there are some that you do. I can't remember which ones they were.
Oh, no, of course, Strasbourg.
Well, Strasbourg's not Kashmir. Strasbourg's really German.
Now it's French.
Yeah, but the name is a German name. Okay, Bourg means what?
Toulouse.
There's an E after the S. Okay, fine. So, the... as the French came up with the concept of raison d'état, and it wasn't just the French, it was French cardinals. I mean, the Austrians, of course, were religiously aghast that they were fighting a war. They really were fighting a war in order to reinstate the Catholic Church. They were also trying to conquer Germany, that's true, but they were also just at least equally motivated by reinstating the Catholic Church. They were just aghast that a fellow Catholic power was opposing them.
How many wars did the Catholic Church directly or indirectly fight?
Too many. That's an interesting question. To answer that one would take a lot of historical work. We've probably forgotten about a lot of the ones that they fought. Okay, weiter. So, this is raison d'état with the beginning of the Enlightenment. That starts a new era. Because the end of the day is, when you say, I don't care that much about religious principle, it's, you know, until Richelieu and Mazarin, religious principle was the rule, and there were almost no exceptions to it. There were people, in other words, the Protestants would ally themselves with Protestants, or maybe not get involved, but that a major Protestant state or major Catholic state should ally itself with someone from the other camp didn't happen.
So then Mazarin was really
Richelieu. Yeah, absolutely, 100% true. Right, Richelieu and Mazarin are the authors of pragmaticism, and that is what we call it today. But they originally call it raison d'état. They call it raison d'état. They call it reasons of state. So this, without a question, these two, the you know the the pragmaticism which these cardinals introduced into practical politics, and a combination of enlightenment. They're like a new, a dawn of almost the beginning of a new era in European history to a large extent. And that starts out a, what we call this, the beginning of the era of what we call philo-Semitism. Philo-Semitism. You know what anti-Semitism is? Well, there's something. There was once something called philo-Semitism.
Philosophical.
No, philo-Semitism. Philo-Semitism? No,
wait,
you don't know
it's from the root.
It's philo. It's philo-Semitism.
Something Jews.
What?
Something about Jews.
It means philo. It means philo-Semites are the opposite of anti-Semites. So it's like this.
Oh, this was the employment of the court Jew.
No. The court Jew comes at around all the same time, and I don't believe it's a coincidence that all these things are all happening all at the same time. The philo sounds like this. It's like this. Erasmus. We've heard of Erasmus.
Yeah.
We've heard of Erasmus. Erasmus is much earlier. Erasmus is right before the Reformation, and many people believe he's like.